Spotify on demand. More stimulating talk radio. When you want, where you want. Powered by.
Deal with common legal matters quickly and affordably, like wills, living trusts, small claims, or LLCs, by visiting LegalZoom.com. Type the word podcast in the referral box at purchase for an extra $10 off. Now, LegalZoom.com welcomes you to the official podcast of KFI AM 640, More Stimulating Weekends.
The John and Ken Show, John Cobalt and Ken Champeau, welcome.
How are
you doing?
You know, contrary to a popular email that's made the rounds, it isn't until July 1st of 2008 that you will not be able to hold the cell phone in your hand while driving your car in California.
People think that it's now the law is in effect.
There was an email that went out. Did I discuss that with you? Because I think you may have been on vacation when I talked about it.
I overheard.
The new driving laws, it's called. It was all full of BS, and one of them was that July 1st of this year, you couldn't hold the cell phone in your hand. It's next year. But you know what? That's already way behind. I knew this day was coming, and apparently the numbers are growing. We're going to talk about it later on. But people using high-speed internet, how about holding a laptop in your lap while you're driving?
The traffic doesn't move.
About banging on a keyboard. Well,
I could,
you could,
I can see why.
You're already hedging.
I can see why.
All right. Just, you know, the list of distracted things we've talked about over there, just going to keep adding to them and keep adding to them.
Well, the traffic doesn't move.
I thought microwaves would come. That hasn't really happy if people be popping in hot dogs.
I read the newspaper while driving a lot if it's going really slow because I get bored.
Right. I would imagine, though, some people will be driving down freeways at 55 miles an hour with a laptop.
Crash and die.
We'll talk about it coming up later on.
Have you been, the Mormon religion has gotten a lot of attention in the last year or so, partly because Mitt Romney is running for president on the Republican side. There's also an HBO show.
I've seen it called Big Love.
Big Love, about the life of polygamists. And I've seen that a couple times. It's fascinating.
He's only got three wives, that guy.
Yeah,
I've seen the show.
Only three. And Mormonism is not something I paid much attention to in life. Didn't really understand it.
We do with the Muslim religion, let's move this aside and call it the fundamentalist Mormon type. These are the polygamists. Polygamy's not been it's been prohibited by the mainline Mormon church back in 1890.
Yeah, but that doesn't stop the polygamists from polygamizing.
True, but they're limited in number as far as the total number of Mormons, just like the Al-Qaeda's are limited in number for the total number of extremist Muslims.
Irene Spencer,
nevertheless, it's fascinating,
has written a book called Shattered Dreams, and it's about her life the subtitle is My Life as a Polygamous Wife. And she married her brother-in-law back in 1953. It was her half-sister's husband.
She was only 16, and turns out her husband ended up with nine more wives.
The guy's name was Verlin LeBaron, and she comes from a polygamous family.
You know, she bore 13 of his 58 kids.
And so now she's written this book to try to explain what life was like. Let's get Irene Spencer on. Irene, how you doing?
Hi, how are you today?
I'm fine.
Explain why fundamentalist Mormons, as you describe them, believe that polygamy is some way to heaven. Is that apparently the thing behind it here?
It's everything behind it. Polygamy was revealed in as early as 1843 to Joseph Smith, and they started living it, and it was essential for their salvation.
All right, let me explain who Joseph Smith is, because he started this Mormon religion, and most people don't know who the hell he is and what it is that Mormons believe in. What was his claim that people started following him as a religious leader?
Well, about the first thing that happened, he said it was revealed to him that every Christian church was an abomination before God, and that God told him to start the Mormon church. So therefore, he started it and became this self-proclaimed prophet.
And so he wrote the rules on how to be a Mormon, and one of the paths to get to heaven was that a man had to accumulate many wives and children.
It actually tells you still in the Doctrine and Covenants that the Mormon Church put out as one of their religious books. It actually tells you in section 132 that you have to live polygamy in order to become gods. And that is their quest, is to become gods. And that's why we lived it. It was essential to salvation.
All right. So that's the rules that he set as the founder of the Mormon Church. Who decided in 1890 to overrule that?
Wilford Woodruff, who was then president of the Mormon Church, issued what they called a manifesto. and it was saying that each man should only have one wife, and from then on they did not allow polygamy in the church.
Which split, I guess, the followers to some extent, because some agreed with the new ruling and others said, no way, we're going to go with the original interpretation from Joseph Smith.
Well, absolutely. The members of the church, some of them were absolutely in awe because it was essential for their salvation, and if they could not live polygamy, then they would not become gods, and therefore they were going to forfeit their salvation. So they went on and lived it anyway and broke away from the church and adhered to the fundamental principles, and that's why they became known as the fundamentalists.
So they actually believe the men become gods?
Absolutely.
No kidding.
I was promised.
Well, if you got to put up with a whole bunch of wives, you should become a god. I mean, there ought to be some reward at the end of all this.
Absolutely.
So, what was it like as a child?
Yeah, apparently your father had how many wives?
Well, at the time that I was born on the scene, it was February 1st, 1937. My father lived in Salt Lake City, and when I was born, he had four wives in the same house at the same time, and I was his 13th of his eventual 31 children.
Whoa.
Now,
and you all live in one. How does that work in terms of the living arrangements?
Well, they just have a bedroom, and he takes turns. He stays with one wife one night, and the next with the next night. And if somebody's feeling bad or has a problem, or if it happened to be their first day or something, then he'd switch nights. But the women just put up with him having his rotation list.
So isn't this just sort of a condoned way of letting a man be, let's just say...
A man.
Yeah, a man.
Villa Rigosa would like this.
According to the scriptures, the Mormon scriptures, it said if a man marries even 10 virgins, and he does it to even 10, it says that he cannot commit adultery with them because they weren't given to anyone else. They were just given to him. So therefore, they said it wasn't adultery. It was for your glory.
So that television show, Big Love, on HBO, does that accurately represent how the family dynamic works?
No, not really. There's part of it, but that is so fictionalized, it wasn't funny. They do, a lot of the wives do live together. I lived with as high as four wives in the house at the same time, but eventually my husband ended up getting places of our own. But most people live in poverty, barely exist. You can imagine my husband had 10 wives and 58 children.
Do you end up hating all the other wives?
Absolutely not. I still have a relationship with him today, and I'll tell you the reason why, is because everything I did and we did it thinking that we were trying to please God, and therefore we did the very best we could, and there were feelings all the time, and you could have cut the air between us. Lots of times people would just barely answer you and not carry on a conversation, but there were jealousies, there were envies, there were hatefulness, but we did it thinking that we were serving the Lord.
So you all had the normal human range of emotions.
Oh,
when it comes
absolutely.
To competing.
I could see that you would bond over this. I could absolutely see that.
Well, you know, we actually did. In fact, the wives were there and attended the births of our children. We lived with the wives more than we lived with the husband because the husband had to go out and go to work. And I myself was in a group, the LeBaron group from Mexico. And my husband would go to the States to work and sometimes be gone two and a half, 3 months at a time. So the women bonded together. That's all we had was one another.
Did you really love this Verlin LeBaron? I mean, you were more or less forced into marrying him at the age of 16, and it was your half-sister's husband already. So I imagine you had no choice but to marry him, correct?
No, I did have a choice.
You did have a choice?
Some of the groups, they marry you off, but I didn't. I had a choice. But I felt I was pushed into it by everybody else saying that they felt that that's what I should do. And after all, my grandmother was a second wife, and my mother was a second wife, and she married her own sister's husband, and so I did it, and it was the thing that was done.
But did you have strong feelings for him?
I was actually in love with another guy that was a Mormon, you know, in the Mormon church, and they said I'd go to hell if I married him and lived in monogamy, and so they cut that off. This is kind of the next best thing if I wanted my glory.
Did he ever mistreat you in any way or any of the other wives?
No, he was one of the kindest, most gentle men you ever had in your whole life. In fact, he never kissed me in and my whole life until we got married. I mean, the first kiss I ever had was at our marriage ceremony.
All right, hold on. When we come back, we got to talk about this guy's brothers. We're talking to Irene Spencer, and she has a book called Shattered Dreams, Her Life as a Polygamist Wife. When we come back, we got to talk about his fundamentalist Mormon brothers, Joel and Ervil. Apparently, there was a murderous rampage conducted by one of them, and that caused her and her family to go on the run. We'll talk about it next.
On the John and Ken Show.
Leo Laporte.
Nowadays, many stores you go, and I saw this at the post office, and they have a sign that says, please, don't be rude. Get off the phone before you get to the counter. I'd like to see more signs in places of business. No cell phone use. You're starting to see that, too. No cell phone use in here. But there's always going to be the rude few. And I agree with you on the cell phones. It just drives me crazy.
Tomorrow morning at 11. Online and on demand. KFIAM640.com.
Hi, this is your holy host. What would Jesus do? Find out tomorrow at 6 a.m.
KFI. AM640.
The John and Ken Show, John Cobell, Ken Shampo. We continue with Irene Spencer. Her book is called Shattered Dreams, My Life as a Polygamous Wife. Her website, IreneSpencerBooks.com. IreneSpencerBooks.com. And Irene not only grew up as a young girl in a polygamist family, she eventually was pushed into marrying her half-sister's husband, her brother-in-law, Verlin LeBaron, and she became one of a number of wives with dozens of children.
Ten! This is 1953. She was only 16, and she bore 13 of this guy's 58 children. His name was Verlin LeBaron.
You were on the run because
one of LeBaron's brothers, I guess Ervil is his name, was you take out one letter, a pretty evil guy. Talk about what happened there.
He was a mass murderer.
Well, yes. In fact, I and my sister and our husband, Verlin, were on his death list because he felt like that we should be following him. He became a self-proclaimed prophet, and we went into hiding. That's one of the reasons why we moved to Nicaragua. We went down there for 2.5 years to be out of the way because he had about 28 of our family and friends and people put to death.
Well, how did he kill them?
He was too chicken to do it himself, but he sent his wives, his children. Right now I have four nephews and nieces that are serving life sentences in prison, and he did not do anything himself. He sent someone else to do it.
It was like Charles Manson.
You said here he butchered 25 to 30 people or had them killed.
Yes.
Including former wives, a daughter, rival members of other clans, including his brother Joel?
Absolutely. He had his own wife. He had one of his own wives. He had one of her kids strangle her to death. And he had a beautiful daughter named Rebecca that was just an absolutely gorgeous girl. And because she rebelled against him, he had two of her half-brothers strangle her to death.
So how many years were you on the run from
Ervil?
Uncle Ervil here?
How many years did we run from him?
Yeah.
Well, actually, the whole time that it was put together was probably around 6 years or something, where we were living in perilous lives and in hiding.
Was coming after you this whole time?
Well, he had gone. We lived low. We actually had people guarding our homes and somebody staying awake all night. We actually had guards on our homes.
What years?
You ended up in Nicaragua, too, which was really awful.
What years did this happen?
Well, Verlin died in 81, and also Ervil died just a couple days before he did. Ervil died in prison, but it was in 81. And we had gone, I guess, in 2 years before that, 3 years before that, to Nicaragua.
We're talking relatively recent modern times, like in the 1970s. You were on the run here from this crazy Ervil. Why didn't the cops catch up with him? And why wasn't this big news? I mean, a guy who had at least 25 people slaughtered. You know, that is Manson territory here.
Well, a lot of it was done in Mexico, and he was apprehended and put in prison in Mexico for a while, and then he, through a bribe, is what we heard, that he got out and he was in hiding throughout Mexico and different places for a long time where nobody could get to him, and he just gave orders and told people what to do, and they carried him out.
At what point in your life did it occur to you that this was all crazy?
The thing of it is when I always questioned it, let's put it back, when his brother, Joel LeBaron, claimed to be a prophet, I think it was 1956, And when he claimed to be a prophet, I was so disillusioned then because they had had a older brother named Ben that had claimed to be the one mighty and strong. That's who the Mormons believe is going to come in the last day and set the house of God in order. And he had claimed it. And all of a sudden here we have Joel claiming it. Then we had Ervil claiming it.
And
I always told people it's button, who's got the button, you know?
Exactly. So you stayed in this situation for quite a number of years, I guess, until 1981.
I was in my marriage for 28 years, and the reason being is that how on earth do you leave when all your relatives are polygamists? They're all poor. They're all isolated. They all believe that if you leave, you're going to hell.
Did you ever imagine just getting on the bus and fleeing to the other side of the country?
Well, you had 13 kids, though, I guess.
I was going to say, yeah, how do you leave when you have 13 kids and get on a bus? But the thing that holds you there is that it's stronger than that. It's brainwashing because they tell you that your husband is going to be your savior. He is going to pull you through the veil into heaven and resurrect you. And if you don't be good, you don't even get your salvation. So why don't you, you know, you just be quiet and stay there and suffer and do whatever it is because you don't want to burn in hell forever.
Now you've been in a monogamous marriage for 19 years, it says, huh?
Oh, absolutely. I have been married to Hector J. Spencer, and it'll be 20 years this December 23rd. And I want you to know that I am not only his only one, but I have finally become the favorite.
All right, good talking with you, Irene.
We appreciate talking. It's a fascinating story. Irene Spencer, and again, the website is irenespencerbooks.com. Shattered Dreams, My Life as a Polygamist Wife. Thanks for talking with us.
Oh, thank you.
All right.
You know, I've been wanting to do that for a long time, talk to a woman that was in one of these polygamous marriages. It's Mormon.
Yeah, it's brainwashing from
like fundamentalist Muslim craziness.
Yeah, it's a wacky religious cult. I'm astonished. Every day I'm astonished how powerful these religions are in terms of controlling people's minds. It's amazing. It's so many people still running around like it's the third century. All right, we come back very soon, you could fire up the internet, high-speed internet, in your car.
In your car. Now, it's not supposed to be for people who are driving. It's supposed to be for the backseat people, right?
Yeah, sure.
Right. We'll talk about it.
That's coming up on the John and Ken Show.
KFI News, powered by the worldwide resources of Fox News. KFI, AM 640.
John and Ken Show, John Cobalt and Ken Shampoo.
Hey, coming up in the next segment, I mean, we just talked to a woman that was part of a polygamist marriage for 28 years to a guy who already had 9 wives. Later on, a woman this week, a British divorcee, announced that she has married Omar bin Laden. Yes.
Omar? Who's
Osama
Omar?
Osama bin Laden's 4th son. He's 27 years old. He's apparently a scrap merchant.
Oh.
She agreed to do an interview with British TV to talk about...
I guess Osama is not feeding them any of the family fortune, huh?
Well, you could make a lot of money off this crap. She's interested in meeting Osama one day and to talk to him about Al-Qaeda. Yeah, believe it or not, it's a true story. We'll talk about Jane Felix Brown. By the way, she's 51. This guy's 27.
Oh, what's that about? Come on.
We'll talk about her in the next...
That's not right. There's something wrong there.
All right, now we know the list of distractions when you're driving, you know, tuning in the radio to the John and Ken Show, maybe munching on a hamburger. Of course, talking on the cell phone, handheld. What's next? The internet. A lot of people already have this, but it's really going to start growing. I predict in the next 5 years, everybody will have high-speed internet access in their vehicles, or at least people that want it.
You know, you see,
it's going to be the hottest new option.
This is what bothers me. You talk about listening to our show, right?
Yeah,
you know how many radio stations there are on the internet? I mean,
I didn't think of that.
It's probably unlimited. Not just the regular radio stations, but there's a lot of amateur radio on the internet, thousands of them. This is not good for business here.
Well, business travelers are already using the internet while on the go. You know, you just bring your laptop and you can plug in for high-speed cellular connections to check email and map routes. And, of course, the people behind this technology will say it's not intended for drivers or anybody in the front seat. It's a company called AutoNet Mobile. The spokesperson says, we don't support front seat services. We're focused on the back seat right now, providing in-car entertainment.
That's the cover-your-ass public relations statement so they don't get sued.
Well,
less likely to get sued.
In February, a 29-year-old guy who might have been using his laptop while driving died when his car veered into an oncoming Hummer SUV up in Yuba City. And CHP said the computer was plugged into the cigarette lighter of the man's Honda Accord and was still running, although the screen was shattered in the accident. They were not able to determine for certain if he was using his laptop as he was driving, but it is...
What do you think?
...believed to be a very strong possibility.
Because
I've been talking about how people are now text messaging while they're driving, using their BlackBerries or their cell phones.
Do you know how many text messages were sent last year?
I have no idea. I did send a few myself.
158 billion.
That's worldwide?
158. I don't know if it's worldwide or national. 158 billion. I don't think I sent one message last year.
I was talking about this over the weekend with some friends, and one was joking. It's like, you text message me all the time. Why don't you just call me? And the guy said, well, it's easy for me to just wrap out my thoughts and send it to you. And he goes, well, I get charged for that.
Why?
I guess their calling plan, you get charged for receiving text messages.
Am I a primitive? Trying to work those tiny little keyboards and find the right letter on each of the...
Yes. It's a pain in the neck, but you get good at it.
Yeah, but isn't it quicker to dial the phone number and leave a voice message?
Yes.
I mean, I've tried to do it, and I've done it a few times, but I'm thinking, well, in the time it took me to, you know, type out the first word, I could have called and left the message.
It's not as cool.
That's just it.
Yeah. Technology now is all about the next cool thing.
But it seems...
And there's a group of people, like this new iPhone, right, who just want the next cool thing.
All right. But
they want to be ahead of everybody
else. To me, it's more technologically advanced to leave your voice than to write it out.
That's true.
That's what I think. It's quicker, and plus...
But it's newer. To see cell phones and leaving voicemail, that's old.
No,
it's like
a
fax machine to these
people. Yeah, but it's 158 billion, so when it gets that big, it can't just be newer. I was thinking that they find it better in some way.
Not just cooler,
but it actually is a better form of communication. And if that's true, I don't get it.
Well, I do get it. You're not really thinking through all of the possibilities. Let's say you're stuck in a meeting. You can't talk on the phone, so you sit there while the boring guy's droning on at the conference.
I don't go to meetings.
Remember Laura Ingle, one of our reporters, would sit there in the courtroom and bang out text messages because she couldn't sit there and speak on the phone during the trial.
She could send information back
to the station.
All right, but
so
I mean,
sometimes
that's a specialized type of work, though. I'm saying in an ordinary person's life, and maybe I don't have an ordinary life, but I'm never in any meeting. And even if I'm in a meeting, I don't have a desire to talk to anybody. I don't have a desire to send out a random message
to a friend. You also hit on another one. I'll admit this because most of my friends don't listen to the show. Sometimes I email people because I'd rather not call them, and then if they pick up the phone, I'm stuck talking to them for 20 minutes, or, you know, I have to say, I just wanted to tell you that I'll see you tonight. Goodbye.
I don't even pick up the phone.
It's easier just to send an email. No, you don't. I know that. But I got friends that do.
I mean,
there are some people, John, that are so connected, they'll answer the phone every freaking time it rings if it's their cell phone. They're on all the time. They want to know. They don't want to miss one word from somebody. I don't get that. You don't get that.
Well, because at home, you know, I have a secret phone.
And when
phone.
I know that that's one of those people, I email them. Or I don't text message.
Well,
my
phone will ring in my house, and it's on the other side of the house, right, my office. And I'll be watching television. My wife will say, aren't you going to answer that? Because my wife answers all phone calls at all times.
There you go.
Right? And she hears the phone ringing, and I go, no, I'm not going to answer it. She goes, well, don't you want to know who it is? No.
I agree. There's two types of people in the world. Those that have to know who it is and those that don't care.
The only message I have to know immediately is if someone close to me died. And if somebody close to me died, they're going to keep calling. The phone keeps going off like two or three or four
times.
Great
example.
And they're finding other phone numbers.
You are the perfect example of that. Do you want to know when?
When?
9/11. 9/11, of course, happened very early in the morning, California time.
Right.
By 6 a.m. or 6:30, obviously, the news was huge and the towers were already in deep peril. You called me over and over and over again that morning.
I did?
And finally, I picked up the phone. Yeah, because our program director at the time had this crazy idea to send you and I to New York City to cover.
No, it was worse than that.
Oh.
He wanted to send us to Pakistan.
I didn't know that. And then there was this idea that we might drive across the country because, shut down all the airports.
You're right. He did want to send us to New York. And then after we decided we're not doing that, he wanted to send us to Pakistan.
Now, wait a minute. When we decided that we want to do that because it was probably not safe, he then moved on to Pakistan.
Hear the Pakistan?
6 years later, I've never heard this version.
Yeah. He seriously thought we should go to Pakistan and settle in Islamabad and start broadcasting from there.
It's a good thing you never told me. I wouldn't have come to work anymore. But that morning, you did not. You called like seven straight times.
Yeah.
I said, oh, my God.
Well, the world
us.
Was ending.
Because
yeah.
I didn't have my TV on. I didn't know what was going on. It was early in the morning. And I said, all right, I got to see what this is. This has got to be something important.
Oh, so you were intentionally ignoring my call?
Well, yeah. Well, I don't even know if I had caller ID then, so I didn't know it was you.
Oh, you just weren't answering anybody.
Yeah, but then I got in my brain what you just said. Maybe somebody died.
Right.
This might be something I really have to address.
Yeah, I mean, if it's not somebody dying, you know, I'll find out in a couple hours later, tomorrow, next week, whatever.
But here's the thing. Even though we're going to make it clear that you cannot sit there with the laptop, you know, on your lap while you're driving, playing it around on the Internet, people are going to do it. We're just going to have another problem. We're going to have legislators in Sacramento going berserk. It'll be against the law, but then there'll be a concern that it is not enforced, and it's causing more driver distractions and more accidents. And
yeah, that's exactly what's going to
happen. Because
you have it all laid out.
That have to answer the phone every time also have to be plugged into the Internet 24/7. So they'll sit there with the laptop while they're driving because they want to know what's going on.
You know,
you and I are not part of this crowd, but they're,
well,
they're there.
It's the BlackBerry crowd.
It is. They call them the Crackberries.
Yeah, these idiots, and a lot of them are these West Side business people, entertainment people. I every once in a while, the BlackBerry system goes down, and there's this obligatory story that they run on the front page, how BlackBerries, you know, went out. There was a power outage for 12 hours, and the CrackBerry people didn't know what to do. And I always read a story about some guy, and he said, you know, I didn't know what to do when my BlackBerry went out, but I had a really nice dinner with my family, and then I read books to my kids, and I sat down and watched a movie with my wife.
I was a human being again.
Yeah, and
not some plugged-in machine.
And he's talking as if he just discovered dinner with the family. He's reading a book to his kids for the first time in his life. He's sitting down and watching a movie with his wife for the first time ever. What, you know, there's, as if he's just stumbled into a wondrous new life. Except, you know, the next day he's going to be back to his stupidity of reading messages every three. And I'm thinking, what the hell's in those messages?
One quick note. You may be curious. They are going to have in-dash computers. It looks like Ford, Nissan, and Volkswagen are working on it. However, you may not be able to access it. You can only access it while you're parked, possibly. Mm. Or only people in the rear seat will get the screens to read. Or it's possible that the in-dash computer will read the screen content aloud, so you don't have to look at it. You can just listen to it like the radio.
Nice.
Those are the possibilities.
All right, well, that could be useful.
All right, when we come back, a woman claims that she has wed one of the sons of Osama bin Laden. We'll talk about it next.
That's coming up on the John and Ken Show.
Matt Drudge.
One day there's going to merge. It will be a Shrek into a Spider-Man, into a Superman, into the Bionic Woman, into a pirate. They did that with, like, Freddy and Friday the 13th and Halloween. They finally, like, merged it. When do we get the last merge there on Baloney Boulevard?
Matt Drudge. Tomorrow night, 7 to 10 on AM 640.
Live, online.
KFI, AM640.com.
Wayne Resnick, make sure you put me in your ear today from 5 to 8 p.m.
KFI,
AM 640.
The John and Ken Show, John Cobalt and Ken Champeau.
Well, is it a hoax or is it real? Jane Felix Brown, 51 years old, from Moulton, Cheshire, in northwestern England.
A grandmother.
Has told the British media that she has married the fourth son of Osama bin Laden.
Omar.
Omar.
Not a good name.
It's pretty close to
Omar bin Laden.
Omar bin Laden.
She met bin Laden while riding a horse.
Near Egypt's Great Pyramid.
Yeah, near the Great Pyramid in Egypt.
I suspect this story already, although they claim they've seen the marriage certificate.
Yeah, but there's something wrong here. She's 51, he's 27.
Oh, she was in Egypt for medical treatment for MS.
And they had Islamic marriage ceremonies. So wait a second, she's a 51-year-old English woman, middle-aged.
She's riding a horse in Egypt with multiple sclerosis.
She runs across bin Laden's son. And
not only that, she's right near the Great Pyramid.
And they've had
it. It was fate. Here he is.
This is from The Onion. This sounds like a hoax story.
Is The Sun a tabloid, John? You read the British papers.
The Sun
printed a copy of what it was said to be their wedding certificate and pictures purportedly showing the couple in Egypt.
They had Islamic marriage ceremonies in Egypt and Saudi Arabia. And going back to what we discussed earlier, she's wife number two. Islam allows men to have up to four wives.
Oh, see, at least the Islamic people limit you. The fundamentalist Mormons, you can have, 100, I guess.
There was no.
Now, of course, there's no independent confirmation of her claim, or that this man is indeed Osama bin Laden's son. Well, do they know if Osama has one name no more?
She's taken another name, Zaina Mohammed. She's got three children by previous marriages, five grandchildren. This would be her sixth marriage.
Oh, she's like Zsa Zsa Gabor of London.
She's just a nut.
Now, she's hoping to arrange a visa to visit, or for her husband to come to, to come to Britain.
Yeah, I don't think
so. Yeah, she acknowledges that'll be difficult.
Not after. Here's a great test to see if British immigration works.
Omar bin Laden's applying to come in.
Here comes bin Laden's son to meet his new wife. See if he gets waved in or not.
Now, she told some British TV program that she would one day like to meet Osama bin Laden, her father-in-law now, to find out if he really is the mastermind behind Al-Qaeda.
What do you mean?
Here's her quote.
To find out.
You know, the newspapers say he did it, and certain newspapers say they don't know. So I would ask, one question I would ask, did you do it? Because I don't know.
I think he said he did it.
He did kind of.
I think he's taking credit.
Right after 9/11,
he's done
a few
victory dances about what happened to the towers.
She married the son, not the father. I just married the man I fell in love with. To me, he's just Omar.
Omar the scrap metal?
That's what it says in the headline, that he's a scrap merchant.
What, does he collect the scraps from the buildings his father blows up?
Now, according to, he's a scrap dealer and one of 18 brothers. He was raised in Sudan and Afghanistan after his father left Saudi Arabia. And she says that Omar has not seen Osama since 2000 in Afghanistan, the year before the 9/11 attacks.
Yeah, I don't think Osama's the kind of dad that keeps in touch.
I'm
just guessing. No,
what
just
do you
don't
do on
think...
Father's Day? Catch up with Osama?
Yeah, I don't. Well, there wouldn't be Christmas cards. Maybe a Ramadan card once a year.
She said he left his father because he did not feel it was right to fight or to be in the army. Omar was training to be a soldier, and he was only 19. So I guess he fled to Egypt. That's where he must have ended up.
Do you think Osama's alive?
It's like Elvis. Yeah, I don't know what to think. Like JFK, people still think.
No, nobody thinks JFK's still alive.
Oh, yeah.
No, get out of here. Who?
The Weekly World News had a story.
Oh, that's a comic book.
All right, well, he was born in 1917, so he'd be pretty old now. He'd be 90, wouldn't he?
I
always remember he's born in 1917.
No, I saw the Zapruder film. His brains roll over the back seat of the car.
That wasn't him.
That was
his stand-in. Remember that Saddam Hussein had doubles. How do we know that JFK didn't have a double in Dallas?
Because JFK was not on the run like Saddam Hussein was. There's
that
a difference. No,
one of the possibilities is you're going to get your brain shot out if you stand in for JFK. I have a feeling, John, just to guess, within the next few weeks we'll hear that this woman's a hoaxer. If they bother to follow this up.
Well, yeah, because I want to...
It is a great story.
Is Omar speaking? There's no quote from Omar here.
No, well, Omar's in Egypt, and he's probably not accessible by the British media.
Is Omar going to want to marry a 51-year-old British woman? What's in it for him, unless he wants access to England to help with some bomb plot?
Killings.
You know, that maybe that's one way. Can you get green card status in Britain
After 9/11, the story just came out a few weeks ago that we helped get members of the bin Laden family out of America. Remember that?
We
so
did.
Not all of them believe in Osama's...
But you just don't deal with any of those people.
All right.
No bin Ladens.
We'll keep an eye on Jane Phoenix Brown.
Yeah.
See whether or not she's there. The daughter-in-law of Osama bin Laden.
Yeah, there's going to be chapter two to this story, I'm sure. Which will probably negate chapter one. All right, we got more coming up after the news. This is the John and Ken Show. Yeah. Hey, it's the John and Ken Show. John Cobalt, Ken Champeau. Welcome again.
Yeah, coming up later on this hour, we've been following the story of California's overpopulated prisons for some time now, and it's going to come to a head soon. But the one that stunned me in the last week is a couple of judges announcing that they're going to consider a prison population cap. In other words, if we just reach a point where they decide there's too many prisons, we're just going to have to release the overflow. If only there could be a cap on crime. I just wish, sometimes judges absolutely amaze me.
Isn't it the stupidest concept you ever heard?
Meanwhile, Lee Baca, the L.A. County Sheriff, has his own idea. Everybody just stay home. That's right.
Everybody get the Paris Hilton treatment.
Right,
everybody go home.
Home confinement.
And don't come out until we tell you.
Solutions to crime.
How
we'll talk
hard
about
is it to build a prison?
Nobody wants to do that.
That's stupid.
You're the only one.
I'm the only guy. Just
you
keep
are.
Building more prisons.
I'd
They're
say
not,
you should get out there with your bricks and start.
Yeah. What is it? Cinder blocks?
You got a little room on your property. Can't you build something up the hill
there? You
know
what? We could probably hold about a half a dozen prisoners, sure.
All right,
I'll do my part.
We'll talk about that coming up later on in the hour.
You ever wonder when there's a serial bank robber and they end up getting some catchy name in the news, and you wonder who came up with the name?
In fact, this past week, there's a report out that they got a guy they're calling the Zorro Bandit because he always wears black, and he robbed a couple of banks this past week. They think he's committed 6 bank robberies since June 1st of last year, actually. And they call him the Zorro Bandit. The guy we're going to talk to...
he's the guy who comes up with the names.
He is a bank robbery specialist in the Los Angeles Bureau of the FBI. And we don't very often have FBI people on the show. No,
usually,
usually
they don't want to come near us. Steve May, FBI Special Agent. Welcome to the John and Ken Show.
Hey, how you doing?
Fine. They let you come on our show?
Apparently so.
Yeah, don't you know there's a memo against FBI agents appearing on our program?
Not that I'm aware of, but I have my media coordinator here, my media, and I like to think of her as my agent slash attorney.
All right, well, hey, it's your career, not mine. So,
Now, are you the guy that actually comes up with the little nicknames for the bandits, or is there like a group of you that sit around a table and throw about ideas?
Popular belief is that, but no, I come up with the majority of the nicknames for them, and I'm always open for suggestions from detectives and other people on our squad.
My favorite is the Irreconcilable Differences Bandit.
Yes.
Well, and you just picked up that guy recently, right?
He was picked up recently in Glendale by Glendale PD.
And he was holding up banks, and what led to the name Irreconcilable Differences?
The first two robberies that he committed, he mentioned the fact that he was going through a divorce and that he wanted to shield the money from his wife. And upon hearing that...
He's actually telling the bank tellers that he's going through a divorce?
Yes.
What, to elicit sympathy?
Probably, yeah.
Did it turn out to be true?
It's a long story, but he formerly wasn't going through a divorce process that he's aware of, and I can't talk too much because it's kind of still an ongoing investigation, but there's some subtle truth to it.
Really, there is?
Yeah.
And how many banks did he end up robbing, or is he accused of robbing?
I guess I have to say alleged because I've heard these shows before. So alleged, I believe it was 17 robberies and a street robbery in Beverly Hills.
Hey, I got when a guy shows up at a bank to rob it, how much money does he get?
It varies. I don't like to disclose amounts because I don't want to encourage robberies or things like that.
Right, but I mean he doesn't get that wealthy from it.
Yeah, generally it's a really small amount. I mean, we ask him, so did you think he got as much as he would based on your perception? They're always like, no, it wasn't worth it.
Boy, because you just have the one teller handing over the money, whatever's in her cabinet there.
Generally, yeah, if it's a one-on-one type robbery, yeah.
And the guy can't really hold out for more because the longer he's in there, the more likely he's going to get caught, so he just has to take what he can get at the one window, right?
Yeah, the better ones won't be in there too long.
And aren't the bills marked or something? I mean, isn't that the common practice so that the money, can't really be spent or what?
Yeah, there's definitely some certain security measures that are placed that the banks do that help us later during the investigation if we are able to apprehend them.
Do they still use that ink blow-up thing that splatters them
on TV?
Yeah, with red paint, or is that from the cartoons?
No, those things are called dye packs, and the banks do employ those security devices.
Well, I mean, I don't want to sound facetious here in asking this question, and I know there is an old expression by one of the longtime bank robbers from years ago, I rob the banks because that's where the money is, but with all the security there and all the cameras, and I look at the pictures of these guys that have earned nicknames, and we'll talk more about them in a few minutes, that none of them, a few of them wear masks, but most of them don't. I just think it's one of the stupidest things in the world to do if you're going to rob, to actually rob a bank, simply because sooner or later you're going to get caught. I just don't understand
Yeah,
I'm not going to argue that. Yeah, it's very stupid to do. Not a smart move.
It seems like it'd be easier just to sell some a phony scam product over the internet and make your money that way.
It was a lot safer.
Yeah. So now let's go through some of the names here. The Preppy Bandit, the Budweiser Bandit. What's the Budweiser Bandit about?
The Budweiser Bandit, on one of the robbers, he was just wearing a Budweiser sweatshirt that had King of the Beers on it, and there was nothing else really descriptive about him, so I just went with that.
And he always wore that sweatshirt? Or
not always, no.
No, but you just like to use that name.
Yeah, on that one, yeah. I mean, he hasn't robbed a lot yet, so we typically try to name him after a couple robberies. So sometimes after about the third or fourth robbery, after you get more of a pattern in their MO, you kind of look back and go, oh, I wish I would have named him this. But at that point, it's kind of a little too late.
How does it help to have a nickname?
It helps me tremendously in terms of tracking him. We cover 7 counties, and also... by providing a nickname to the bandit, when we work with the other local law enforcement agencies, when we disseminate the photos and the information about the robbers, we don't have to go through all the MO or everything else. You just give them the moniker name, and they know right away who you're talking about.
And it has to be a minimum number of holdups, and then they get the nickname or something?
We typically try to go for two or more, but sometimes if it's a great photo and it's a serious robbery, if it's only one and we are able to get media attention on it in terms of releasing the photographs, we'll try to come up with a name right then.
The Asian merchant bag bandit? What the heck is that?
He was just an Asian male robbing, and he always used a blue merchant bag with him. So, and you got to remember, a lot of these, they've been naming bank robbers here in Los Angeles for years, so a lot of the names are already taken. So you gotta can't.
Well, doesn't a name get retired after a while, and you can reuse it?
I think the irreconcilable difference is the one will be retired.
Like a ball player's number.
That one.
Hey, but
do you feel like possibly you're giving them, I don't know, some sort of attention and some sort of cool name that they might like?
Most of them that I've talked to don't like them.
Oh, they don't like the names.
They hate them.
I heard one. I don't think it was you, but I did hear one guy was called the Big Nose Bandit.
I named them that.
Oh, you did? Okay.
Unrelated to that, they know their names, and it's great when they you interview them and they reference it too.
What did the Big Nose Bandit say about his name?
He knew about it. I wasn't there during the interview, but through the other agents, I heard he had referenced it or something.
The Enormous Ears Bandit.
Yes. The tellers describe them as having larger than normal ears.
Now, who is this supposed to help? Bank security on the lookout? A guy comes in with big ears? They ought to, you know, get ready.
That's the guy.
We get those pictures and we send them out. We have a great distribution list for the banks and local law enforcement. So a lot of times when the bandits are hitting on a regular basis, those pictures get out. So when they go into the banks, all the tellers are aware of the individuals inside the bank. So it helps us out and help out the response time for the police departments as well.
Now the L.A. Dodger Bandit. The Dodgers must have been thrilled with that.
Oh, yeah, I don't know about that. That was named by another agent, and he was named prior to my taking over as coordinator.
I see. Oh, he wore the baseball cap? Is that?
Yeah, it was just an L.A. Dodger baseball cap.
Oh, yeah, you're right. John's right. Now, this past week, you guys sent out a press release, your press relations office, about the Zorro Bandit. I guess this is a new one, or at least a new one. No, not a new one. You think he's been robbing banks since last year, but
yes.
It looks like he did a few robberies this past week.
Just recently, yeah. He, the other day on July 10th.
Now, he doesn't wear the little eye mask. He just wears black, and he doesn't speak, like, accented English.
Yeah, I don't know. I just
Who's the actor who did Zorro?
The mustache and everything just kind of reminded me of that character in the movie. So.
Antonio Banderas in the movies of recent, but you're talking about
never use a
60s. His name was Guy something, wasn't it?
Guy Williams. Oh, yeah, the actor from Lost in Space.
Right, I think he played Zorro in the TV series.
Yeah.
No.
So can you hang on the line?
Sure.
I want to ask you just about the behavior of bank robbers as well.
Okay.
I mean, because it's kind of an odd thing to do. I mean, I'm with you. I just don't
understand. I mean, you'd be better off just knocking over a 7-Eleven. Banks have there's so much on the lookout for robbers. Although sometimes security guards at my bank look like they're 90 years old and half asleep.
Well, that's part of the thing. I'm amazed these guys ever get out of the bank. You would think that the banks would have somebody tackling them immediately.
We'll talk more. Steve May is an FBI special agent in the reason we're talking to him, and he's with the Los Angeles region, as you heard, a number of counties, and he's the man that gives the bank robbers their little nicknames, and we'll talk to him more when we come back.
That's coming up next on the John and Ken Show.
Hi, I'm Jillian Michaels, TV's toughest fitness guru. I'm here to motivate you towards positive change. Join me tomorrow morning at 9 a.m.
KFI, AM 640.
The John and Ken Show, John Cobell and Ken Shampo. We continue with Steve May, an FBI special agent. He's the man. This is a great job to have. He gives nicknames to serial bank robbers.
Seven-county area here in Southern California, what they call Greater Los Angeles. So chances are, if you know of a bank robber, a serial bank robber here in Southern California, and he's got a nickname, Steve was responsible for giving it. 470 of them in 2006 in the seven-county area. There was 470 robberies.
So the irreconcilable differences bandit, the guy who is robbing money to pay for his divorce.
The banana bandit. Well, we should ask him about that.
What was the banana bandit about?
He actually has been robbing down in the Orange County area. The one robbery, he walks in, and he just starts unloading all this stuff on the teller counter, and one of the items that he put on the teller counter was a banana.
What, was he just clearing his pockets so he had room for the money?
I guess, I don't know. I mean, on other robberies, he's left a bag of he placed a bag of chips and everything else, so.
What is the weirdest one that you've observed, serial robber, in terms of his habits or his nature?
Oh, weirdest one. I don't know, they're all pretty much They're difficult. The ones that rob every so often are the ones that kind of interest me more. It's kind of, what are they doing? Have they been picked up for something else?
John, look, you robbed. Apparently they named one Mr. Magoo.
Yeah, that's
I can't take credit for that one.
Yeah, well,
that was an agent invention.
Oh, a Ventura detective, right, came up with the nickname for the Magoo bandit.
My wife
and, oversized spectacles.
Yes.
Yeah, my wife and Ken have been calling me Mr. Magoo for a long time.
Well, the possibility exists, Steve, I guess, that some of these guys do wear stuff in order to disguise themselves, which could lead to your nickname, but it's kind of their intention to throw people off as to what they really look like, I guess.
Yeah, they'll wear baseball hats, sunglasses. A lot of them will wear layers of clothing to disguise their physical nature of themselves.
We talked about why a guy does this, because it seems like a high risk, low return. You can't stay in the bank long. The one teller is only going to give you so much money, probably a predetermined amount, I imagine, the bank decides. How come the bank doesn't have a guy who stands at the door and just pulls out a gun right away and tackles the guy or subdues him?
We
don't encourage that at all, no.
Really? I would think you'd have somebody just like a sharpshooter.
You don't want a wild
Why not?
Because you could get plugged.
Yeah, you just
stand there with your little paycheck.
But you know what? You just take out a couple of guys at the door. That'll reduce the number of bank robberies, I would think.
If that were to happen, it'd probably slow down for about a month, and it'd just pick right back up. So.
Well, has bank robber crime gone up or down in Southern California, say, over the last 10 years?
Yeah, actually, over the last decade, it's been going down.
It has been going down.
Yes.
Well, why would they do this with all the cameras there?
It's just desperation, and it's like that famous person, I think it was Willie Sutton. It's where the money is.
Yeah, but the money's all over the place, though. You can go to any convenience store, any gas station, liquor store, and get some money, and you've got far fewer cameras looking at you, less security, less evidence, less witnesses, and all that.
It's the perception of the robber. I mean, all a bank has to them is money. Where 7-Eleven or Blockbuster, I mean, you're not going to have the amounts of cash that a bank might have.
Do these guys go back to the same bank sometime later?
After a while, they need a double, we call it double backing or doubling up. If one of the banks they got a good take, they might go back to that branch.
I mean, wouldn't a smart robber really spread out the banks geographically?
If they're smart, they'd have a job. I think these guys are stupid.
Our last one, the Goofy Hat Bandit, who has been, I guess, alleged to have robbed 39 banks, he was all over the area. He was he never doubled up on a bank. He was a little more experienced at it from a prior, he was a prior bank robber, so.
What percentage of them are career criminals, and what percentage of them are desperate guys who've gone broke? Something bad's happened to them, and this is their last
day. Occasionally you hear about a really old guy robbing banks, and you wonder about that.
Yeah, when I was up working in San Francisco, when the rents were really high during the dot-com boom, there was a guy, an older, really older gentleman, that had a handgun, and you could tell he was, like, almost shaking with the gun. He was robbing because the rent's out, and I believe it was in Palo Alto, had gone up so high he can afford it, so he resorted to robbing banks.
Now, so do most of them are career criminals?
I'd say a large percent are career criminals. A lot of them, a high percent are drug users, next because followed by gamblers.
Because it seems like the kind of thing that some dumb guy down on his luck, broke, you know, lost his job, wife divorced him. This is the kind of cliched thing you'd do. You'd rob a bank.
It's desperation, yeah. I mean, a lot of them have hit rock bottom, and, you know, they need money. So for some reason, the perception is, hey, a bank, it's got money, and I'm going to go there.
And if you get convicted of one-armed bank robbery, how many years in prison is that?
If you go federal, the maximum, if it's armed, is 25 years. But they generally fall back on the federal sentencing guidelines, which varies based on your criminal history.
Hey, I take it women are rare in this field, huh?
Definitely rare.
I mean, you guys buzzing about
it? They don't do it, but yeah, it's rare.
Were you guys buzzing about the pizza delivery man story out of Erie, Pennsylvania? The guy that, claimed he was a hostage and had the bomb around his neck. And, of course, this happened 4 years ago, but just this past week, they revealed that they believe he was part of the plot to rob the bank. That was a weird story, wasn't it?
Right, because he had the bomb that blew up on him.
Right, but he said he was innocent and he was just forced to wear the bomb around his neck and rob the bank.
Yeah, I don't know all the details of it, and obviously, if I did, I can comment on it, but it does interest me quite a bit what really transpired during that time.
Do guys take hostages very often anymore?
Bank robbers?
Yeah.
Well, since I've been here, there's the definition of hostage. If you go into the bank and you hold the employees there for, you know, a decent duration, like 15 minutes or half hour, then we consider that a hostage. But in terms of going in there and, you know, pointing the gun to them and then demanding the money, that rarely happens, if at all.
All right. Steve, good talking
with
you.
Yeah, we really appreciate it. Steve May, FBI special agent. And the next time you hear about a bank robber getting a nickname, it's probably Steve who did it, who named it. All right, when we come back, we'll turn our attention to California's overcrowded prisons. people still trying to come up with solutions, including a couple of judges who said, I tell you what, we're just going to put a cap on the prison population. When you go over this certain number, I just have to release people. Real bright. We'll talk about it next.
That's coming up on the John and Ken Show.
Hi, Wayne Resnick here. I was just talking to John and Ken during the break, and they told me to tell you to listen to my show coming up at 5 o'clock.
KFI.
AM 640.
John and Ken Show continues. John Cobalt and Ken Shampoo.
One of my favorite business stories from the past week, we'll talk about in the next segment. There is a large telecommunications company, a cell phone company, that decided that if you complain too much, they're just going to get rid of you. They're going to just terminate your contract. They're tired of customers who call their complaint lines constantly every month, and they just said, we'll just get rid of them. You rarely hear about that. You always hear about companies that are just trying to hold on desperately to customers. They have customer service people who are trained to deal with your complaint and make sure you stay with the company.
Well, we've always been like that. People complain about the show. Don't listen.
We don't care.
Yeah.
But it's on you.
We got no customer complaint desk here. You don't like it? Go listen to something else.
We'll talk about it in the next segment.
Now, here, we've been covering this story for months. There's two judges who are considering whether to put a population cap on California's prison system, which is beyond capacity, has been beyond capacity for years, and the governor hasn't done anything about it.
Nobody
over the
has.
Years. Nobody has.
Apparently it's double the capacity. We got 170,000 state prisoners, and that is probably two times as much as we can fit.
Now,
so rather than work all these years at building new prisons and handling the problem, because, you know,
that's the only thing you can do.
It is the only thing.
There is no other solution. If you have too many prisoners staying for too long a time, then you have to build more prisons.
Yeah, but instead people would rather hand-wring and talk about ways to make sure they don't go to prison in the first place.
Well, those people have to be taken away.
Ways to rehabilitate them so they don't go back to prison.
It's all a waste of air.
Ways to divert them to some other program which will teach them skills.
This is an argument from the 1970s. It didn't work. When they did this crap in the 1970s, 1980s, it was a disaster. Crime was very high.
Then the 90s came, and we went with three strikes because we had enough.
Three strikes, you put away people forever. What do you know? The crime rate drops dramatically.
But you know, I believe in the big cycle. We're back now.
Well, you have to fight the cycle. You got to fight the cycle because there's no reason for the cycle to change. It's been wildly successful. Sometimes you cycle because you try a new method, it works for a while, and then it stops working, so you got to go to something else. This is still working. You keep bad guys inside prisons, they can't commit crimes outside. I mean, how complicated is this?
I'm doing the math here. Schwarzenegger and the legislature passed a $7.4 billion prison expansion program, which is more borrowing, that will add 40,000 new prison beds. Now, if we're overcrowded by about 85,000 prisoners, because they said we've got double the amount we should have, that means, John, that there's going to be about 45,000 prisoners who are still, that's still too many. So that's why these judges are saying, well, I got an idea. Let's just set a cap on the state prison population. If you go over the cap, then you just got to start releasing people. That's their answer.
That's stupid.
Yeah, I mean, wish there was a cap on the amount of crime. I wish there was a cap on the amount of guys who are sent to prison.
There
isn't.
You have to deal with what you've got. If you've got a certain amount of crime, or you have criminals who require very long stays, such as, you know, three strikes criminals, then it is what it is. You can't change it. Sending them home just means they're going to commit more crimes, and then they'll be back. See, that's the thing. If you throw them out early, and that would solve the problem of the overcrowded prisons, you know, maybe people could live with slightly shorter sentences, except these are bad guys, and then they'll be back in the system very shortly. I mean, most prisoners commit new crimes once they're back out on the street. So why do they think you're going to lessen the population problem simply by releasing them? That doesn't make any sense.
Now, meanwhile,
the reason we want these guys in prison for a long time is because they're such recidivists.
Lee Baca, the L.A. County Sheriff, who, of course, came to worldwide prominence lately over the Paris Hilton fiasco, and he was going to send her to home confinement. That's his answer to the prison overcrowding population. He's going to ask for the power to force, this is interesting, force thousands of inmates to be placed on home detention. Because apparently some of them don't want home detention. According to their advocates, that would deprive them of medical and mental health care that they get when they're in prison.
How ironic is that?
It is weird. I thought they would embrace this.
Because Paris Hilton was sent home because she had medical problems that they thought they couldn't deal with. And now you hear you have the rest of the prisoners saying, no, no, we want to stay here because the medical treatment is actually very good, and we can't get good medical treatment on the outside. Makes you wonder how many of these guys actually enjoy being in prison because it regulates their life. I've heard that.
Wouldn't it be preferable to be home? I mean, you have to wear that home, that electronic ankle bracelet, but I would think rather than sitting there in a cell all day.
It's preferable for you and I to be home, but some of these guys, they can't make themselves toast and eggs in the morning. I've heard a lot of guys say they enjoy the routine. They know what time the meals are.
Yeah, you're right.
They know what time work is, what time TV is, what time they're going to sleep.
They just need wives, don't they? But they really need. That gives you a regimen. You're always on the go. If you weren't married, you'd be in prison. I'm sure of it. I've said that to many people.
I'm probably homeless.
But you're talking about a routine. You're talking about discipline and authority.
And they like that because, you know, if they could control their lives, they'd have jobs, they'd have families, and they'd be normal. But the truth is they can't. They go on the outside, they start drinking, they start taking their drugs. They start running around, and they get into trouble. They can't hold a job. A lot of them have personality disorders, and it's impossible for them to hold a job. So sooner or later, they need money, and they need money, they start stealing things.
All right, there is another aspect to this, though. Many inmates do not apply for the current home detention program, because it is voluntary, because they have a feeling, John, thanks to early release, if they stay in jail, they might get out early. I have a feeling if you go on home detention, you have to serve. Well, it says here you have to serve your full sentence minus any normal credits.
Well, yeah,
but if you're actually in the prison system, you have a shot of winning the lottery and getting out early. So that's apparently the reason a number of inmates prefer to stay in jail.
Again, why are they making this so complicated?
Build more jails.
Build more jails.
That's what State Senator Jeff Denham says. He's a Republican from Salinas, and he says, "I take a tough stance on crime. If you commit it, you have to do the time. We should not be creating a system where the rich and famous like Paris Hilton, who can afford a good attorney, get different treatment. The answer is to build more jails."
Well, it's what the tax money is for. It's what people want. I mean, seriously, do you think if there was some kind of referendum on this, don't you think people would say, "Yeah, let's build prisons?"
Yeah.
I mean, let's build prisons and let's house as many inmates as we can. It's a sign of a functioning, intelligent society when you put all the bad guys away and you don't let them out. Because you know what? There is no possible way to deal with young adults or middle-aged adults who can't control their impulses and can't lead a semi-orderly life. There's nothing you can do about that. We gave that. Like I said before, we gave that chance to those ideas, you know, 20 and 30 years ago, it just didn't work. Because I don't know how you change people in the middle of their life. There's nobody I know, nobody I've ever known in my entire life, who's radically changed their habits, their belief system, you know, their discipline system in the middle of their life. It just doesn't happen. You are what you are. And yeah, you mellow out as you get older. You might get more relaxed. You might get a little more tired of dealing with trouble. But on the whole, if you're a screw-up, you're a screw-up.
Oh, by a certain age.
Yeah, I mean,
you're destined to be whatever you're going to be.
So it seems like all these pleas, you know, a lot of them come from, you know, the Democratic legislators, are just fantasies. It's like, well, what if? What if we could do this? What if we get? Well, it'd be great. You know, if they worked, that would be great. But it doesn't work. If all these rehabilitation ideas worked, we would have went for it 30 years ago. Everybody would have applauded. You guys are geniuses. Wow, this costs a lot less money. There's a lot less people behind bars. Bah, 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 bah. But it didn't work. And there's no evidence that it will work.
How surprised were you?
Some lunatics, you know, like Mark Leno, who think you can rehabilitate child rapists. No, you can't. I don't know. I think
most people, you and I weren't, but during the Paris Hilton thing, when you know the news came out that most inmates in L.A. County only serve 10% of the sentences, this story says it's 25%. But Baca and his spokesholes were saying, oh, you know, Paris served 3 days and her sentence was about 25 days.
See, they don't care. Because what Baca and the rest of these officials are doing, they're it's like they're running a business. They got to keep their people coming in, people coming out. They don't care how long they're staying. All they're trying to do
they don't want them.
They're managing.
It's easy to run a prison system with little inmates.
They got a big hotel. They're managing the vacancy rate. All right.
They don't want the riots.
They're just like the clerk at a hotel. They call you up. Hey, you got to be out at noon. Checkout time is noon. No, I can't give you a late checkout. No, I can't give you an extra day. We're booked. There's another family coming in 3 hours. You got to get out of here. That's what they're doing. So they don't care. It's not their problem. Baca would be happy to have another jail because then he'd get less of a hassle. But for some reason, the idiot county supervisors don't build another jail. Who knows why? because they want to give money away to, you know, illegal aliens and poor people and all the sob stories.
Well, it would only cost $10 a day for home confinement, it says. $70 a day to be in the jail
system. But that's not punishment. That's not punishment.
You can't leave the property.
You sit home. You're driving have a 12-pack of beer. You're watching porno on your satellite TV. What's the punishment?
By the way, the question I would ask, too, is do we have the personnel to chase all these guys if they run off their property? If they go beep, beep, beep? Yeah, that could be hundreds or thousands a day.
It's going to be thousands a day. So who's going to monitor all that? Nobody. I bet you those stupid bracelets won't even work.
All right.
Like everything else, it's just a scam.
When we come back, you may have heard of one of the big cell phone companies named Sprint. They've decided that if you complain too much, you, the customer, they're just going to get rid of you. It's an unusual tactic. We'll talk about it next.
That's coming up on the John and Ken Show.
KFI's big story. We are on.
Two Republican senators say they're going to introduce a bill that would make a big change in the U.S. mission in Iraq.
We just launched an investigation into complaints, if you will, that Ms. Hilton received some treatment that is not otherwise afforded other inmates.
KFI, AM 640. More stimulating talk radio. Armstrong and Getty. Tomorrow afternoon at 5.
KFI, AM 640.com.
Show, John Cobalt and Ken Champeau.
Well, Sprint Nextel is the number three U.S. wireless service provider. They have 53 million customers. Now, in context of this, what they've done isn't that big a deal, but they've basically canceled about 1,000 to 1,200 of their customers. Why? Because they called the customer service line too often and complained too much.
Well, some of these whack jobs were calling customer service hundreds of times a month for 6 to 12 months.
Sincere, sometimes they would call and they wanted the information about other people's accounts. What the hell's that about?
You know what?
They're spying on somebody?
I got a cell phone.
You've never called?
To complain? No, because as long as I'm dialing the number and it connects, what else do I want?
Yeah, I called once because the billing didn't make sense. It was something on my bill, but I wouldn't know if that was a complaint.
See, I've given up trying to understand phone bills. Whatever they charge me, I pay.
Oh, you see, that's the problem. We did this story years ago. They stick in these little weird charges that we ought to start screaming about.
I know.
A few cents here and a few cents there.
It's one of my few surrenders in life. Phone bills are impenetrable. Whatever you want here. Here's the money.
I was doing the math, and they're saying that these 1,000 to 1,200 customers have called the company about 40,000 times a month in total, which would be about 40 times a month. That's more than once a day.
And then every day, because it says some of this goes on for 6 to 12 months. Okay?
Is that all they do?
Well,
call up the Sprint customer complaint line?
It's the insane.
It is. When you consider 53 million customers and they have to axe 1,000, there's 1,000 insane people with Sprint cell phone service.
There's more than that, probably.
There's more in this building.
I mean, the crazy people, a tiny percentage of crazy people end up costing...
Correct. All your resource
the majority of the time that the customer reps have. So why not get rid of those 1,000 people?
No, it's a very smart decision. Of course, the other companies are acting like, we would never do this. Customer service is very important to us. Sprint is really not taking care of their customers. No, I think they're smart.
They're
calling it the Sprint Ahead campaign.
Don't you get the same idiots writing us all the time, bitching about one thing or another?
Funny you should say that. The answer is yes.
Right.
Matter of fact, we get the same idiots writing to us all the time about everything.
And
I would say if I broke our email down, we get a lot of email. There's probably, 10% of all of our listeners responsible for 75% of our email. How's that sound?
There you go. And a lot of times they're bitching about one thing or another.
Third or so are bitching. Most are just sending us stories.
Now, we appreciate the stories and the news tips.
No, we get great stuff.
And the strong opinions on stuff. But there's a certain a group that just kind of wastes their time. And there's only so many emails we can read. There's only so much action we can take. And after a while, it's like, you know what? If you got a problem, maybe you ought to be going.
Yeah, here's something.
Go listen to some country music.
We have reporters come in here from either TV or the newspapers, they don't really get this, and it's always worth explaining. Phone calls and emails are a very small percentage of our total audience. Really small. But they always act like, let me see what the phone lines are doing. And tell me about your email, acting like it's going to represent all of the John and Ken listeners. Not even close.
A lot of
Most people listen to our show, enjoy it, and then move on with their lives.
You know what? So much is made of email responses or postings on websites. I can't believe how many times I read newspaper articles where they're discussing one controversy or another, and they say, well, we went online and posters on this blog said. It's like, what? Why would that matter? People actually respond to like a few hundred whack jobs emailing criticism. The other day I was looking at a news story, and I print out the news story, and I thought it was going to be a page or two out of the printer, and it ended up being 41 pages.
All the blogging posts, the comments.
There were 39 pages of comments to the news story, and I'm thinking,
I don't want this.
Who posts on a newspaper website a comment, and then who posts it on page 39? Like, who's going to read your comment on page 39?
Right, well, the answer to your first question is the people that post now feel like they're part of the story and it gives them attention.
But you're not.
Somebody might read my post.
Yeah, 10 people might read the first few posts. But once you're on page 38,
yeah, you can forget
your post number 462, nobody's going to read that.
No. But don't you look at the thread and it's just they're all responding to each other?
Yeah, they start calling each other names. It usually devolves in less than 10.
Sounds like our show.
In less than 10 posts. In less than 10 posts, it devolves into half a dozen people calling each other names.
So can we cancel listeners? Do you want to do that?
Oh, I've always been in favor of that. We've fired a few people.
No, but we can write back to them and say, if you don't like it, go listen to another show. But can we do more? I'm asking if we can do something else. Go to their homes and take their radios. Go to their cars and pull out our frequency.
It's like we could say, look, give us your address. We're coming over tomorrow. We're going to pull all the radios out of your
house.
Can
we block the signal to specific people? Can you work on that for me?
Yeah, that's... That's more complicated. So I know how to drive over an unplugged radio.
Blocking what? We put a man on the moon. Why can't we block our signal to some listeners?
All right. We're done for now. We'll be back Monday at 3. Wayne Resnick up next. John and Ken Show. KFI AM 640. More stimulating talk radio.